especially because there were men and women working here without life support systems. Establishing Camp Alpha had been hard work, for everything had had to be manhandled through the chain of airlocks, sledded down the slope from the hub, and then retrieved and unpacked. Sometimes, when the braking parachutes failed, a consignment had ended up a good kilometer away, out on the plain. Despite this, several crew members had asked permission to make the ride. Norton had firmly forbidden it. In an emergency, however, he might be prepared to reconsider the ban. Almost all this equipment would stay here, for the labor of carrying it back was unthinkable, in fact, impossible. There were times when Norton felt an irrational shame to be leaving so much human litter in this strangely immaculate place. When they finally departed, he was prepared to sacrifice some of their precious time to leave everything in good order. Improbable though it was, perhaps millions of years hence, when Rama shot through some other star system, it might have visitors again. He would like to give them a good impression of Earth. Meanwhile, he had a rather more immediate problem. During the last 24 hours, he had received almost identical messages from Mars and Earth. It seemed an odd coincidence. Perhaps they had been commiserating with each other, as wives who lived safely on different planets were liable to do under sufficient provocation. Rather pointedly, they had reminded him that, even though he was now a great hero, he still had family responsibilities. The commander picked up a collapsible chair and walked out of the pool of light into the darkness surrounding the camp. It was the only way he could get any privacy, and he could also think better away from the turmoil. Deliberately turning his back on the organized confusion behind him, he began to speak into the recorder slung around his neck. Original full personal file, dupes to Mars and Earth. Hello, darling. Yes, I know I've been a lousy correspondent, but I haven't been aboard ship for a week. Apart from a skeleton crew, we're all camping inside Rama, at the foot of the stairway we've christened Alpha. I have three parties out now, scouting the plane, but we've made disappointingly slow progress, because everything has to be done on foot. If only we had some means of transportation. I'd be very happy to settle for a few electric bicycles. They'd be perfect for the job. You've met my medical officer, Surgeon Commander Ernst. He paused, uncertainly. Laura had met one of his wives. But which? Better cut that out. Erasing the sentence, he began again. My M.O., Surgeon Commander Ernst, led the first group to reach the cylindrical sea, 15 kilometers from here. She found that it was frozen water, as we'd expected, but you wouldn't want to drink it. Dr. Ernst says it's a dilute organic soup, containing traces of almost any carbon compound you care to name, as well as phosphates and nitrates and dozens of metallic salts. There's not the slightest sign of life, not even any dead microorganisms. So we still know nothing about the biochemistry of the Ramans, though it was probably not wildly different from ours. Something brushed lightly against his hair. He had been too busy to get it cut, and would have to do something about that before he next put on a space helmet. You've seen the vidis of Paris and the other towns we've explored on this side of the sea. London, Rome, Moscow. It's impossible to believe that they were ever built for anything to live in. Paris looks like a giant storage depot. London is a collection of cylinders linked together by pipes, connected to what are obviously pumping stations. Everything is sealed up, and there's no way to find out what's inside without explosives or lasers. We won't try these until there are no alternatives. As for Rome and Moscow, excuse me, Skipper, priority from Earth. What now? Norton said to himself. Can't a man get a few minutes to talk to his families? He took the message from the sergeant and scanned it quickly, just to satisfy himself that it was not immediate. Then he read it again, more slowly. What the devil was the Rama Committee? And why had he never heard of it? He knew that all sorts of associations, societies, and professional groups, some serious, some completely crackpot, had been trying to get in touch with him. Mission Control had done a good job of protection, and would not have forwarded this message unless it was considered important. 200-kilometer winds. Probably sudden onset. Well, that was something to think about. But it was hard to take it too seriously on this utterly calm night, and it would be ridiculous to run away like frightened mice when they were just starting effective exploration. Norton lifted a hand to brush aside his hair, which had somehow fallen into his eyes again. Then he froze, the gesture uncompleted. He had felt a trace of wind several times in the last hour. It was so slight that he had completely ignored it. After all, he was the commander of a spaceship, not a sailing ship. Until now, the movement of air had not been of the slightest professional concern. What would the long-dead captain of that earlier endeavor have done in a situation such as this? Norton had asked himself that question at every moment of crisis in the last few years. It was his secret, which he had never revealed to anyone. And, like most of the important things in life, it had come about quite by accident. He had been captain of the Endeavor for several months before he realized that it was named after one of the most famous ships in history. True, during the last 400 years, there had been a dozen Endeavors of sea and two of space, but the ancestor of them all was the 370-ton Whitby Collier that Captain James Cook, R.N., had sailed around the world between 1768 and 1771. With a mild interest that had quickly turned to an absorbing curiosity, almost an obsession, Norton had begun to read everything he could find about Cook. He was now probably the world's leading authority on the greatest explorer of all time, and knew whole sections of the journals by heart. It still seemed incredible that one man could have done so much with such primitive equipment, but Cook had been not only a supreme navigator, but also a scientist, and, in an age of brutal discipline, a humanitarian. He treated his own men with kindness, which was unusual. What was quite unheard of was that he behaved in exactly the same way to the often hostile savages in the new lands he discovered. It was Norton's private dream, which he knew he would never achieve, to retrace at least one of Cook's voyages around the world. He had made a limited but spectacular start, which would certainly have astonished the captain, when he once flew a polar orbit directly above the Great Barrier Reef. It had been early morning on a clear day, and from 400 kilometers up, he had had a superb view of that deadly wall of coral, marked by its line of white foam, along the Queensland coast. He had taken just under 5 minutes to travel the whole 2,000 kilometers of the reef. In a single glance, he could span weeks of perilous voyaging for that first endeavor. And through the telescope he had caught a glimpse of Cooktown and the estuary where the ship had been dragged ashore for repairs after her near-fatal encounter with the reef. A year later, a visit to the Hawaii Deep Space Tracking Station had given him an even more memorable experience. He had taken the hydrofoil to Kealakekua Bay, and as he moved swiftly past the bleak, volcanic cliffs, he felt a depth of emotion that had surprised and even disconcerted him. The guide had led his group of scientists, engineers, and astronauts past the glittering metal pylon that had replaced the earlier monument, destroyed by the great tsunami of 68. They had walked on for a few more yards across black, slippery lava to the small plaque at the water's edge. Little waves were breaking over it, but Norton scarcely noticed them as he bent down to read the words. Near this spot, Captain James Cook was killed, February 14, 1779. Original tablet dedicated August 18, 1928, by Cook Sesquicentennial Commission, replaced by Tricentennial Commission, February 14, 2079. That was years ago, and 100 million kilometers away. But at moments like this, Cook's reassuring presence seemed very close. In the secret depths of his mind, Norton would ask, "Well, Captain, what is your advice?" It was a little game he played on occasions when there were not enough facts for sound judgment, and one had to rely on intuition. That had been part of Cook's genius. He always made the right choice. Until the end, at Kealakekua Bay. The sergeant waited patiently while his commander stared silently out into the night of Rama. It was no longer unbroken, for at two spots about 4 kilometers away, the faint patches of light of exploring parties could be clearly seen. "In an emergency, I can recall them within the hour," Norton told himself. And that, surely, should be good enough. He turned to the sergeant. "Take this message. Rama Committee, care of PlanetCom. Appreciate your advice, and we'll take precautions. Please specify meaning of phrase, sudden onset. Respectfully, Norton, Commander, Endeavor." He waited until the sergeant had disappeared toward the blazing lights of the camp, then switched on his recorder again. But the train of thought was broken, and he could not get back into the mood. The letter would have to wait for some other time. It was not often that Captain Cook came to his aid when he was neglecting his duty, but he suddenly remembered how rarely and briefly poor Elizabeth Cook had seen her husband in 16 years of married life. Yet she had borne him 6 children, and outlived them all. His wives, never more than 10 minutes away at the speed of light, had nothing to complain about. 17. Spring. During the first nights in Rama, it had not been easy to sleep. The darkness and the mysteries it concealed were oppressive, but even more unsettling was the silence. Absence of noise is not a natural condition. All human senses require some input. If they are deprived of it, the mind manufactures its own substitutes. And so, many sleepers had later complained of strange noises, even of voices, which were obviously illusions, because those awake had heard nothing. Dr. Ernst had prescribed a simple and effective cure. During the sleeping period, the camp was now lulled by gentle, unobtrusive background music. During this night, Norton found the cure inadequate. He kept straining his ears into the darkness, and he knew what he was listening for. But though a faint breeze did caress his face from time to time, there was no sound that could possibly be taken for that of a distant, rising wind. Nor did either of the exploring parties report anything unusual. At last, around ship's midnight, he went to sleep. There was always a man on watch at the communications console in case of any urgent messages. No other precautions seemed necessary. Not even a hurricane could have created the sound that did wake Norton and the whole camp, in a single instant. It seemed that the sky was falling, or that Rama had split open and was tearing itself apart. First, there was a rending crack, then a long, drawn-out series of crystalline crashes, like a million glass houses being demolished. It lasted for minutes, though it seemed like hours. It was still continuing, apparently moving away into the distance, when Norton got to the message center.
Hub Control, what's happened?
Just a moment, Skipper. It's over by the sea. We're getting the light on it.
8 kilometers overhead, on the axis of Rama, the searchlight began to swing its beam out across the plain. It reached the edge of the sea, then started to track along it, scanning around the interior of the world. A quarter of the way around the cylindrical surface, it stopped. Up there in the sky, or what the mind still persisted in calling the sky, something extraordinary was happening. At first, it seemed to Norton that the sea was boiling. It was no longer static and frozen in the grip of an eternal winter. A huge area, kilometers across, was in turbulent movement, and it was changing color. A broad band of white was marching across the ice. Suddenly, a slab, perhaps a quarter of a kilometer on a side, began to tilt upward like an opening door. Slowly and majestically, it reared into the sky, glittering and sparkling in the beam of the searchlight. Then it slid back and vanished beneath the surface, while a tidal wave of foaming water raced outward in all directions from its point of submergence. Not until then did Norton fully realize what was happening. The ice was breaking up. All these days and weeks, the sea had been thawing far down in the depths. It was hard to concentrate because of the crashing roar that still filled the world and echoed around the sky, but he tried to think of a reason for so dramatic a convulsion. When a frozen lake or river thawed on Earth, it was nothing like this. But of course, it was obvious enough now that it had happened. The sea was thawing from beneath, as the solar heat seeped through the hull of Rama. And when ice turns into water, it occupies less volume. So the sea had been sinking below the upper layer of ice, leaving it unsupported. Day by day, the strain had been building up. Now the bank of ice that encircled the equator of Rama was collapsing, like a bridge that had lost its central pier. It was splintering into hundreds of floating islands, which would crash and jostle into each other until they, too, melted. Norton's blood ran suddenly cold when he remembered the plans that were being made to reach New York by sledge. The tumult was swiftly subsiding. A temporary stalemate had been reached in the war between ice and water. In a few hours, as the temperature continued to rise, the water would win, and the last vestiges of ice would disappear. But in the long run, ice would be the victor, as Rama rounded the sun and set forth once more into the interstellar night. Norton remembered to start breathing again. Then he called the party nearest the sea. To his relief, Rodrigo answered at once. No, the water hadn't reached them. No tidal wave had come sloshing over the edge of the cliff.
So now we know, he added calmly, why there is a cliff.
Norton agreed silently. But that hardly explains, he thought, why the cliff on the southern shore is 10 times higher. The hub searchlight continued to scan around the world. The awakened sea was steadily calming, and the boiling white foam no longer raced outward from capsizing ice floes. In 15 minutes, the main disturbance was over. But Rama was no longer silent. It had awakened from its sleep, and ever and again there came the sound of grinding ice as one berg collided with another. Spring had been a little late, Norton told himself, but winter had ended. And there was that breeze again, stronger than ever. Rama had given him enough warnings. It was time to go. As he neared the halfway mark, Norton once again felt gratitude to the darkness that concealed the view above and below. Though he knew that more than 10,000 steps still lay ahead of him, and could picture the steeply ascending curve in his mind's eye, the fact that he could see only a small portion of it made the prospect more bearable. This was his second ascent, and he had learned from his mistakes on the first. The great temptation was to climb too quickly in this low gravity. Every step was so easy that it was hard to adopt a slow, plodding rhythm. But unless one did this, after the first few thousand steps, strange aches developed in the thighs and calves. Muscles that one never knew existed started to protest, and it was necessary to take longer and longer periods of rest. Toward the end of the first climb, Norton had spent more time resting than climbing, and even then, it was not enough. He had suffered painful leg cramps for the next 2 days, and would have been almost incapacitated had he not been back in the zero-gravity environment of the ship. So this time, he had started with almost painful slowness, moving like an old man. He had been the last to leave the plane, and the others were strung out along the half-kilometer of stairway above him. He could see their lights moving up the invisible slope ahead. He felt sick at heart at the failure of his mission, and even now hoped that this was only a temporary retreat. When they reached the hub, they could wait until any atmospheric disturbances had ceased. Presumably there would be a dead calm there, as at the center of a cyclone, and they could wait out the expected storm in safety. Once again, he was jumping to conclusions, drawing dangerous analogies from Earth. The meteorology of a whole world, even under steady-state conditions, was a matter of enormous complexity. After several centuries of study, terrestrial weather forecasting was still not absolutely reliable. And Rama was not merely a completely novel system, it was also undergoing rapid changes, for the temperature had risen several degrees in the last few hours. Yet there was no sign of the promised hurricane, though there had been a few feeble gusts from apparently random directions. They had now climbed 5 kilometers, which, in this low and steadily diminishing gravity, was equivalent to less than 2 on Earth. At the third level, 3 kilometers from the axis, they rested for an hour, taking light refreshments and massaging leg muscles. This was the last point at which they could breathe in comfort. Like old-time Himalayan mountaineers, they had left their oxygen supplies here, and now put them on for the final ascent. An hour later, they had reached the top of the stairway and the beginning of the ladder. Ahead lay the last vertical kilometer, fortunately in a gravity field only a few percent of Earth's. A 30-minute rest, a careful check of oxygen, and they were ready for the final lap. Norton made sure that all his men were safely ahead of him again, spaced out at 20-meter intervals along the ladder. From now on, it would be a slow, steady haul, extremely boring. The best technique was to empty the mind of all thoughts and to count the rungs as they drifted by. 100, 200, 300, 400. He had just reached 1,250 when he realized that something was wrong. The light
shining on the vertical surface immediately in front of his eyes, was the wrong color, and it was much too bright. Norton did not even have time to check his ascent or to call a warning to his men. Everything happened in less than a second. In a soundless concussion of light, dawn burst upon Rama.
18. Dawn. The light was so brilliant that for a full minute Norton had to keep his eyes clenched tightly shut. Then he risked opening them and stared through barely parted lids at the wall a few centimeters in front of his face. He blinked several times, waited for the involuntary tears to drain away, and then turned slowly to behold the dawn. He could endure the sight for only a few seconds, then he was forced to close his eyes again. It was not the glare that was intolerable. He could grow accustomed to that. But the awesome spectacle of Rama, now seen for the first time in its entirety. Norton had known exactly what to expect. Nevertheless, the sight had stunned him. He was seized by a spasm of uncontrollable trembling. His hands tightened around the rungs of the ladder with the violence of a drowning man clutching at a lifebelt. The muscles of his forearms began to knot, yet at the same time, his legs, already fatigued by hours of steady climbing, seemed about to give way. If it had not been for the low gravity, he might have fallen. Then his training took over, and he began to apply the first remedy for panic. Still keeping his eyes closed and trying to forget the monstrous spectacle around him, he started to take deep, long breaths, filling his lungs with oxygen and washing the poisons of fatigue out of his system. Presently, he felt much better, but he did not open his eyes until he had performed one more action. It took a major effort of will to force his right hand to open. He had to talk to it as though it were a disobedient child, but presently he maneuvered it down to his waist, unclipped the safety belt from his harness, and hooked the buckle to the nearest rung. Now, whatever happened, he could not fall. He took several more deep breaths, then, still keeping his eyes closed, he switched on his radio. He hoped his voice sounded calm and authoritative as he called, "Captain here. Is everyone okay?" As he checked off the names one by one and received answers, even if somewhat tremulous ones, from everybody, his own confidence and self-control came swiftly back to him. All his men were safe and were looking to him for leadership. He was the commander once more. "Keep your eyes closed until you're quite sure you can take it," he called. "The view is overwhelming. If anyone finds that it's too much, keep on climbing without looking back. Remember, you'll soon be at zero gravity, so you can't possibly fall." It was hardly necessary to point out such an elementary fact to trained spacemen, but Norton had to remind himself of it every few seconds. The thought of zero gravity was a kind of talisman, protecting him from harm. Whatever his eyes told him, Rama could not drag him down to destruction on the plain, 8 kilometers below. It became an urgent matter of pride and self-esteem that he should open his eyes once more and look at the world around him. But first, he had to get his body under control. He let go of the ladder with both hands and hooked his left arm under a rung. Clenching and unclenching his fists, he waited until the muscle cramps had faded away. When he felt quite comfortable, he opened his eyes and slowly turned to face Rama. His first impression was one of blueness.
The glare that filled the sky could not have been mistaken for sunlight. It might have been that of an electric arc. So Rama's sun, Norton told himself, must be hotter than ours. That should interest the astronomers. And now he understood the purpose of those mysterious trenches, the Strait Valley and its five companions. They were nothing less than gigantic strip lights. Rama had six linear suns, symmetrically ranged around its interior. From each, a broad fan of light was aimed across the central axis to shine upon the far side of the world. Norton wondered if they could be switched alternately to produce a cycle of light and darkness, or whether this was a planet of perpetual day. Too much staring at those blinding bars of light had made his eyes hurt again. He was not sorry to have a good excuse to close them for a while. It was not until then, when he had almost recovered from this initial visual shock, that he was able to devote himself to a much more serious problem. Who, or what, had switched on the lights of Rama? By the most sensitive tests that man could apply to it, this world was sterile. But now, something was happening that could not be explained by the action of natural forces. There might not be life here, but there could be consciousness, awareness. Robots might be waking after a sleep of eons. Perhaps this outburst of light was an unprogrammed, random spasm, a last dying gasp of machines that were responding wildly to the warmth of a new sun, and would soon lapse again into quiescence, this time forever. Yet Norton could not believe such a simple explanation. Bits of the jigsaw puzzle were beginning to fall into place, though many were still missing. The absence of all signs of wear, for example, and the feeling of newness, as if Rama had just been created. These thoughts might have inspired fear, even terror. Somehow, though, they did nothing of the sort. On the contrary, Norton felt a sense of exhilaration, almost of delight. There was far more here to discover than they had ever dared to hope. Wait, he said to himself, until the Rama Committee hears about this. Then, with calm determination, he opened his eyes again and began a careful inventory of everything he saw. First, he had to establish some kind of reference system. He was looking at the largest enclosed space ever seen by man, and he needed a mental map to find his way around it. The feeble gravity was little help, for with an effort of will, he could switch up and down in any direction he pleased. But some directions were psychologically dangerous. Whenever his mind skirted these, he had to vector it hastily away. Safest of all was to imagine that he was at the bowl-shaped bottom of a gigantic well, 16 kilometers wide and 50 deep. The advantage of this image was that there could be no danger of falling farther. Nevertheless, it had some serious defects. He could pretend that the scattered towns and cities, and the differently colored and textured areas, were all securely fixed to the towering walls. The various complex structures that could be seen hanging from the dome overhead were perhaps no more disconcerting than the pendant candelabra in some great concert hall on Earth. What was quite unacceptable was the cylindrical sea. There it was. Halfway up the well shaft, a band of water, wrapped completely around it with no visible means of support. There could be no doubt that it was water. It was a vivid blue, flecked with brilliant sparkles from the few remaining ice flows, but a vertical sea, forming a complete circle 20 kilometers up in the sky, was such an unsettling phenomenon that after a while, he began to seek an alternative. That was when his mind switched the scene through 90 degrees. Instantly, the deep well became a long tunnel, capped at each end. Down was obviously in the direction of the ladder and the stairway he had just ascended, and now, with this perspective, he was at last able to appreciate the true vision of the architects who had built this place. He was clinging to the face of a curving, 16-kilometer-high cliff, the upper half of which overhung completely until it merged into the arched roof of what was now the sky. Beneath him, the ladder descended more than 500 meters until it ended at the first ledge, or terrace. There, the stairway began, continuing almost vertically at first in this low-gravity regime, then slowly becoming less and less steep until, after breaking at five more platforms, it reached the distant plain. For the first 2 or 3 kilometers, he could see the individual steps, but thereafter, they had merged into a continuous band. The downward swoop of that immense stairway was so overwhelming that it was impossible to appreciate its true scale. Norton had once flown around Mount Everest and had been awed by its size. He reminded himself that this stairway was as high as the Himalayas, but the comparison was meaningless. And no comparison at all was possible with the other two stairways, Beta and Gamma, which slanted up into the sky and then curved far out over his head. Norton had now acquired enough confidence to lean back and glance up at them briefly. Then he tried to forget that they were there. Too much thinking along these lines evoked yet a third image of Rama, which he was anxious to avoid at all costs. This was the viewpoint that regarded it once again as a vertical cylinder, or well. But now, he was at the top, not the bottom, like a fly crawling upside down on a domed ceiling with a 50-kilometer drop immediately below. Every time he found this image creeping up on him, he needed all his willpower not to cling to the ladder in mindless panic. In time, he was sure, all these fears would ebb. The wonder and strangeness of Rama would banish its terrors, at least for men who were trained to face the realities of space. Perhaps no one who had never left Earth and had never seen the stars all around him could endure these vistas. But if any men could accept them, Norton told himself with grim determination, it would be the captain and crew of the Endeavor. He looked at his chronometer. This pause had lasted only 2 minutes, but it had seemed a lifetime. Exerting barely enough effort to overcome his inertia and the fading gravitational field, he started to pull himself slowly up the last 100 meters of the ladder. Just before he entered the airlock and turned his back upon Rama, he made one final, swift survey of the interior. It had changed, even in the last few minutes. A mist was rising from the sea. For the first few 100 meters, the ghostly white columns were tilted sharply forward in the direction of Rama's spin. Then they started to dissolve in a swirl of turbulence as the uprushing air tried to jettison its excess velocity. The trade winds of this cylindrical world were beginning to etch their patterns in its sky. The first tropical storm in unknown ages was about to break.
19. A warning from Mercury. It was the first time in weeks that every member of the Rama Committee had made himself available. Professor Solomons had emerged from the depths of the Pacific
where he had been studying mining operations along the mid-ocean trenches. And to nobody's surprise, Dr. Taylor had reappeared, now that there was at least a possibility that Rama held something more newsworthy than lifeless artifacts. The chairman had fully expected Dr. Pereira to be even more dogmatically assertive than usual, now that his prediction of a Raman hurricane had been confirmed. To His Excellency's great surprise, Pereira was remarkably subdued, and accepted the congratulations of his colleagues in a manner as near to embarrassment as he was ever likely to achieve. The exobiologist was, in fact, deeply mortified. The spectacular breakup of the cylindrical sea was a much more obvious phenomenon than the hurricane winds, yet he had completely overlooked it. To have remembered that hot air rises, but to have forgotten that hot ice contracts, was not an achievement of which he could be very proud. However, he would soon get over it and revert to his normal Olympian self-confidence. When the chairman offered him the floor and asked what further climatic changes he expected, he was careful to hedge his bets. "You must realize," he explained, "that the meteorology of a world as strange as Rama may have many other surprises. But if my calculations are correct, there will be no further storms, and conditions will soon be stable. There will be a slow temperature rise until perihelion and beyond, but that won't concern us, because Endeavour will have had to leave long before then."
"So, it should soon be safe to go back inside?"
Probably. We should certainly know in 48 hours.
"A return is imperative," said the ambassador from Mercury.
"We have to learn everything we possibly can about Rama. The situation has now changed completely."
"I think we know what you mean, but would you care to elaborate?"
"Of course. Until now, we have assumed that Rama is lifeless, or at any rate uncontrolled. But we can no longer pretend that it is a derelict. Even if there are no life forms aboard, it may be directed by robot mechanisms, programmed to carry out some mission, perhaps one highly disadvantageous to us. Unpalatable though it may be, we must consider the question of self-defense."
There was a babble of protesting voices, and the chairman had to hold up his hand to restore order.
"Let His Excellency finish," he pleaded. "Whether we like the idea or not, it should be considered seriously."
"With all due respect to the ambassador," said Taylor in his most disrespectful voice, "I think we can rule out as naive the fear of malevolent intervention. Creatures as advanced as the Ramans must have correspondingly developed morals, otherwise they would have destroyed themselves, as we nearly did in the 20th century. I've made that quite clear in my new book, Ethos and Cosmos. I hope you received your copy."
"Yes, thank you, though I'm afraid the pressure of other matters has not allowed me to read beyond the introduction. However, I'm familiar with the general thesis. We may have no malevolent intentions toward an antheap, but if we want to build a house on the same site..."
"This is as bad as the Pandora Party. It's nothing less than interstellar xenophobia."
"Please, gentlemen, this is getting us nowhere. Mr. Ambassador, you still have the floor."
The chairman glared across 380,000 kilometers of space at Conrad Taylor, who reluctantly subsided, like a volcano biding its time.
"Thank you," said the ambassador from Mercury.
"The danger may be unlikely, but where the future of the human race is involved, we can take no chances. And, if I may say so, we Hermians may be particularly concerned. We may have more cause for alarm than anyone else." Taylor snorted audibly, but was quelled by another glare from the moon.
"Why Mercury, more than any other planet?" asked the chairman.
"Look at the dynamics of the situation. Rama is already inside our orbit. It is only an assumption that it will go around the sun and head on out again into space. Suppose it carries out a braking maneuver. If it does so, this will be at perihelion, about 30 days from now. My scientists tell me that if the entire velocity change is carried out there, Rama will end up in a circular orbit only 25 million kilometers from the sun. From there, it could dominate the solar system.
For a long time, nobody, not even Taylor, spoke a word. All the members of the committee were marshaling their thoughts about those difficult people, the Hermians, so ably represented here by their ambassador. To most people, Mercury was a fairly good approximation of hell. At least, it would do until something worse came along. But the Hermians were proud of their bizarre planet, with its days longer than its years, its double sunrises and sunsets, its rivers of molten metal. By comparison, the Moon and Mars had been almost trivial challenges. Not until men landed on Venus, if they ever did, would they encounter an environment more hostile than that of Mercury. And yet this world had turned out to be, in many ways, the key to the solar system. This seemed obvious in retrospect, but the space age had been almost a century old before the fact was realized. Now, the Hermians never let anyone forget it. Long before men reached the planet, Mercury's abnormal density hinted at the heavy elements it contained. Even so, its wealth was a source of astonishment, and had postponed for 1,000 years any fears that the key metals of human civilization would be exhausted. And these treasures were in the best possible place, where the power of the sun was 10 times greater than on frigid Earth. Unlimited energy, unlimited metal, that was Mercury. Its great magnetic launchers could catapult manufactured products to any point in the solar system. It could also export energy in synthetic transuranium isotopes or pure radiation. It had even been proposed that Hermian lasers would one day thaw out gigantic Jupiter, but this idea had not been well received on the other worlds. A technology that could cook Jupiter had too many tempting possibilities for interplanetary blackmail. That such a concern had ever been expressed said a good deal about the general attitude toward the Hermians. They were respected for their toughness and engineering skills, and admired for the way in which they had conquered so fearsome a world. But they were not liked, and still less were they completely trusted. At the same time, it was possible to appreciate their point of view. The Hermians, it was often joked, sometimes behaved as if the sun were their personal property. They were bound to it in an intimate, love-hate relationship, as the Vikings had once been linked to the sea, the Nepalese to the Himalayas, the Eskimos to the tundra. They would be most unhappy if something came between them and the natural force that dominated and controlled their lives. At last the chairman broke the long silence. He remembered the sun of India and shuddered to contemplate the sun of Mercury. So he took the Hermians seriously indeed, even though he considered them uncouth technological barbarians.
"I think there is some merit in your argument, Mr. Ambassador," he said slowly. "Have you any proposals?"
"Yes, sir. Before we know what action to take, we must have the facts. We know the geography of Rama, if one can use that term, but we have no idea of its capabilities. And the key to the whole problem is this. Does Rama have a propulsion system? Can it change orbit? I would be very interested in Dr. Pereira's views."
"I've given the subject a good deal of thought," answered the exobiologist. "Of course, Rama must have been given its original impetus by some launching device, but that could have been an external booster. If it does have onboard propulsion, we've found no trace of it. Certainly there are no rocket exhausts or anything similar anywhere on the outer shell.
They could be hidden.
True, but there would seem little point in it. And where are the propellant tanks, the energy sources? The main hull is solid. We've checked that with seismic surveys. The cavities in the northern cap are all accounted for by the airlock systems. That leaves the southern end of Rama, which Commander Norton has been unable to reach, owing to that 10-kilometer-wide band of water. There are all sorts of curious mechanisms and structures up on the South Pole. You've seen the photographs. What they are is anybody's guess. But I'm reasonably sure of this. If Rama does have a propulsion system, it's something completely outside our present knowledge. In fact, it would have to be the fabulous space drive people have been talking about for 200 years.
You wouldn't rule that out.
Certainly not. If we can prove that Rama has a space drive, even if we learn nothing about its mode of operation, that would be a major discovery. At least we'd know that such a thing is possible.
What is a space drive?
Asked the ambassador from Earth, rather plaintively.
Any kind of propulsion system, Sir Robert, that doesn't work on the rocket principle. Anti-gravity, if it is possible, would do very nicely. At present, we don't know where to look for such a drive, and most scientists doubt it exists.
It doesn't,
Professor Davidson interjected.
Newton settled that. You can't have action without reaction. Space drives are nonsense. Take it from me.
You may be right,
Pereira replied with unusual blandness. But if Rama doesn't have a space drive, it has no drive at all. There's simply no room for a conventional propulsion system with its enormous fuel tanks.
It's hard to imagine a whole world being pushed around, said Solomons. What would happen to the objects inside it? Everything would have to be bolted down. Most inconvenient.
Well, the acceleration would probably be very low. The biggest problem would be the water in the cylindrical sea. How would you stop that from...
Pereira's voice faded away, and his eyes glazed over. He seemed to be in the throes of incipient epileptic fit, or even a heart attack. His colleagues looked at him in alarm. Then he made a sudden recovery, banged his fist on the table, and shouted,
"Of course! That explains everything! The southern cliff! Now it makes sense!"
"Not to me,"
grumbled the lunar ambassador, speaking for all the diplomats present.
"Look at this longitudinal cross-section of Rama,"
Pereira continued excitedly, unfolding his map.
"Have you got your copies? The cylindrical sea is enclosed between two cliffs, which completely circle the interior of Rama. The one on the north is only 50 meters high. The southern one, on the other hand, is almost 0.5 kilometer high. Why the big difference? No one's been able to think of a sensible reason. But suppose Rama is able to propel itself, accelerating so that the northern end is forward. The water in the sea would tend to move back. The level at the south would rise, perhaps hundreds of meters, hence the cliff. Let's see."
He started scribbling furiously. After an astonishingly short time, it could not have been more than 20 seconds, he looked up in triumph.
"Knowing the height of those cliffs, we can calculate the maximum acceleration Rama can take. If it was more than 2% of a gravity, the sea would slosh over into the southern continent."
"A 50th of a G? That's not very much."
"For a mass of 10 million megatons, it is. And it's all you need for astronomical maneuvering."
"Thank you very much, Dr. Pereira,"
said the Hermian ambassador. You've given us a lot to think about. Mr. Chairman, can we impress on Commander Norton the importance of looking at the South Polar region?
He's doing his best. The sea is the obstacle, of course. They're trying to build some kind of raft, so that they can at least reach New York.
The South Pole may be even more important. Meanwhile, I am going to bring these matters to the attention of the General Assembly. Do I have your approval?
There were no objections, not even from Dr. Taylor. But just as the committee members were about to switch out of circuit, Sir Lewis raised his hand. The old historian seldom spoke. When he did, everyone listened.
Suppose we do find that Rama is active and has these capabilities. There is an old saying in military affairs that capability does not imply intention.
How long should we wait to find what its intentions are? Asked the Hermian. When we discover them, it may be far too late.
It is already too late. There is nothing we can do to affect Rama. Indeed, I doubt if there ever was.
I do not admit that, Sir Lewis. There are many things we can do, if it proves necessary. But the time is desperately short. Rama is a cosmic egg, being warmed by the fires of the sun. It may hatch at any moment.
The chairman of the committee looked at the ambassador from Mercury in frank astonishment. He had seldom been so surprised in his diplomatic career. He would never have dreamed that a Hermian was capable of such a poetic flight of imagination.
20. Book of Revelation. When one of his crew called him Commander, or worse still, Mr. Norton, there was always something serious afoot. He could not recall that Boris Rodrigo had ever before addressed him in such a fashion, so this must be doubly serious. Even in normal times, Rodrigo was a grave and sober person.
"What's the problem, Boris?" he asked when the cabin door closed behind them.
"I'd like permission, Commander, to use ship priority for a direct message to Earth."
This was unusual, though not unprecedented. Routine signals went to the nearest planetary relay. At the moment, they were working through Mercury, and even though the transit time was only a matter of minutes, it was often 5 or 6 hours before a message arrived at the desk of the person for whom it was intended. 99% of the time, that was quite good enough. But in an emergency, more direct and much more expensive channels could be employed at the captain's discretion.
"You know, of course, that you have to give me a good reason. All our available bandwidth is already clogged with data transmission. Is this a personal emergency?"
"No, Commander. It is much more important than that. I want to send a message to the Mother Church."
"Uh-huh," said Norton to himself. "How do I handle this?"
"I'd be glad if you'd explain."
It was not mere curiosity that prompted Norton's request, though that was certainly present. If he gave Rodrigo the priority he asked, he would have to justify his action. The calm, blue eyes stared into his. He had never known Rodrigo to lose control, to be other than completely self-assured. All the Cosmo-Christers were like this. It was one of the benefits of their faith, and it helped to make them good spacemen. Sometimes, however, their unquestioning certainty was just a little annoying to those unfortunates who had not been vouchsafed the revelation.
"It concerns the purpose of Rama, Commander. I believe I have discovered it."
"Go on."
"Look at the situation. Here is a completely empty, lifeless world, yet it is suitable for human beings. It has water and an atmosphere we can breathe. It comes from the remote depths of space,
aimed precisely at the solar system. Something quite incredible, if it was a matter of pure chance. And it appears not only new, it looks as if it has never been used. We've all been through this dozens of times.